And now for reading and writing and radio.
I know the names of all of the dogs that live in my neighborhood. These are the names of all of the dogs that live in my neighborhood. Corky, Princess, Tuffy, Sooner, Bessie Blue, and Bernard, Florey, Ripper, Duchess, Ringo, Pepper, Whiskers, Pudding, Smokey, Boots, Kimmy, Snorky, Waggles, Fluffle, Cookie, Twinkle, Chee-Chee, Winnie, Andy, Ralph, Skipper, Melina, Husky, Sam, Gemini, Dodo, Dum Dum, Oliver, Strawberry, Misty, Mooch, Snoopy, Butch, Barney, Shakespeare, Maud, Magoon, Brownie, Binker, Elena, Honey, Puggy, Newman, Lady, Missy, Storm, Shorty, and Lumpy von Eichenruh. Now you know the names of all of the dogs that live in my neighborhood.
The author of that catalog of dogs was John Nofel of Sangamon State University. But what mutts do you know? WSSR Radio at Sangamon State University presents Reading and Writing and Radio, a program about creative writing. Your host is Jacqueline Jackson, children's author and professor of literature at Sangamon State University.
In ancient Greece, where the Olympics first originated, the winner didn't receive a prize or a medal or a trophy, but a wreath, a special wreath made of laurel leaves to be worn as a crown. A top athlete was a laureate. Other tops wore laurel wreaths, too. In Roman times, the Roman emperors, the Caesars, were always pictured on their coins and on their statues wearing laurel wreaths around their brows. The word laureate has come down through the ages and is active in our day in the term poet laureate, top poet. England has long had a poet laureate who holds the honor till his or her death. Here's the beginning of a poem by Robert Southey, who was a poet laureate many, many years ago, and he mentions the word laureate in it, and he's writing about a little waterfall in England. "How does the water come down at Lodore?" my little boy asked me thus once on a time. And moreover, he tasked me to tell him in rhyme. Anon at the word, there first came one daughter, and then came another, to second and third the request of their brother, to hear how the water comes down at Lodore, with its rush and its roar, as many a time they had seen it before. So I told them in rhyme, for of rhymes I had store, and 'twas in my vocation for their recreation that so I should sing, because I was laureate to them and the king. The United States has never had a poet laureate, but Robert Frost was certainly our unofficial one. Illinois' poet laureate could have been Vachel Lindsay or Edgar Lee Masters or Carl Sandburg. But Illinois does now have an official poet laureate, Gwendolyn Brooks of Chicago. She's been sponsoring a yearly contest for young poets. 10 senior high and 10 elementary students are selected from poetry they submit in the spring. Last year, Verdon sent in many entries to the 13th contest. This year, I'm hoping that we'll all enter. Therefore, we're starting early in the fall to focus on poetry so that come May, you'll all have plenty of poems to choose from. Not all of us can make it to the top, but there's plenty of room for class laureates, school laureates, town laureates. I'd like us to have a reading and writing and radio laureate at our jamboree next spring, maybe a bunch of laureates, and we can each be the laureate of our own family. To start us off on the right poetic foot today, I have here with me poet John Nofel of Sangamon State University, who's my friend and colleague in the Lit program. He read to you his poem, Dogs' Names, to start our show. John, how long have you been writing poetry? Did you start as a kid?
No, I started about as a high school senior, Jackie.
High school senior.
Yeah, about 100 years ago.
And what got you started? What made you write in poetry rather than in prose?
Well, just seeing some of the work of other poets in the school books, I wanted to be able to do something like that. Yeats and his friends.
Mm-hmm. So the reading of the poetry inspired you to the writing of the poetry.
That's right, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And you found that this was a way that you liked to express yourself.
Well, it was a challenge, you know, to use the language well. That's what a writer tries to do, even when he's playing games with it.
You've had a number of books, many books of poetry published. Have you had any in particular published for young people?
Well, two from McGraw-Hill, Dogs and Cats and Things Like That, which is the book I read the dogs' names from,
mm-hmm.
and then Our Street Feels Good. They're the two books for children. The others are for adults, mm-hmm. the other books.
How about reading us some selections?
Well, I can give you two from Our Street Feels Good.
Okay.
One deals with just things that you might find at the breakfast table, and another one deals with sounds, kind of
okay.
things you could hear when you close your eyes. Two pieces of bread on a blue plate, elderberry jelly, purple in a jar, a tablecloth printed with deep red roses, elderberry, bread, and red roses. What will you trade for these? And the other one, now we are quiet. We have covered our eyes. The clock begins to tick louder. A bird is making small whistles in a bush. A boy is walking down a long street away. Far away there are engines humming, and yet there is so much quiet, so much more than we had ever thought of.
Oh, I like that one.
Mm-hmm.
We have quiet, we have covered our eyes, and then the heightened hearing that you get.
You listen for something and you get a sense of how much silence is out there.
Now I see that you've got some markers in another book, another two books.
Mm-hmm.
Is there something out of that second book that...
Well, I have poems that would appeal more to high school students than elementary school.
Mm-hmm. Well, we do have some high school students listening in, so why don't we have one of the high school students' poems, too, one for older kids and adults?
Well, with those of earlier poems that I read, I was just trying to pick up from the experience of the small child who would know about bread and jelly and the tablecloth and whatnot, or
mm-hmm.
what he could hear if he closed his eyes. I have a kind of a folk story here called Tunnel Blaster on Bear and Brotherhood. And here, the voice is all important. You try to get a craggy voice going and see how far you can carry it.
Well, let's hear your craggy voice, John.
Yes, this is a disgusting poem, Jackie.
All right. If you mean disgusting in subject matter, I think this is a good thing to tell poets.
Here we go now.
Anything is possible for subject matter.
Okay. You know him, do you? Why, it's true as I'm standing here. He went off on a weekend. He thought he'd hunt bear with his brother, but the bear ate his brother, and he shot the bear. He came back in here on the Monday with a bear meat sandwich, wanted me to eat a half of it, see how a bear meat sandwich tasted. I told him I'm damned the day I ate any man's brother, but he said there wasn't nothing to it. The bear didn't have time to digest his brother. Ever hear of anything ugly as that? And he throws the grizzlies marshmallows. I've seen him Sundays do it in the zoo.
Oh, I think that very well illustrates the point, John, that anything is possible grist for a poet's mill.
Actually, it's based on a story a man who was building a tunnel told me, and I just put it into that, kind of colloquial language.
Mm-hmm.
You have to... It seems a lot simpler than it is. You have to rewrite maybe 100 or 200 times to get the language to come out right.
My poetry teacher, my writing teacher, first writing teacher in college, would assign students to go and write a sonnet on the city dump.
Mm-hmm.
And he had two reasons for that. One, he said, is that those that figured that all poetry had to be sweet and beautiful. Flowers and things like that would have to turn out a poem about the city dump, and then those that figured that a poem could just be running off at the mouth, sort of verbal diarrhea, had to put it into a very careful verse form of what they would get at the city dump.
Yeah, it sounds like he got them both ways, didn't he?
Yes.
A shrewd teacher.
Well, now there you've read a poem that you considered for older kids or adults, and mm-hmm. then you read a couple that you considered for younger kids. Do you make a distinction between children's poetry and adult poetry?
Well, that's difficult, but essentially they're the same if they've been worked and they're good. I don't like poems that write down to children, it's the same order of things. You're looking for connections where you haven't seen them before. You're looking for images. You're looking for a good rhythmic line, this kind of thing. There is no distinction except in terms of the audience they go to.
When my daughter Jill was 4 years old, I started reading poetry to the kids other than mm-hmm. nursery rhymes because I realized that I hadn't been. And I read them some children's poetry and some, quote, adult poetry. Mm-hmm. And the next day, I read more than I intended because they were enjoying it before they went to bed. And the next day I said to little Jilly, of all those poems I read last night, which one did you like the best? And she said promptly, the one about the king. And I thought and thought because I hadn't read any poem about a king. And finally, at the end of the day, it came to me. I had read the poem of Coleridge's, In Xanadu did Kublai Khan a stately pleasure dome decree, and I had started ahead of time by saying this is Kublai Khan was a Chinese king,
right,
an emperor. And she had liked the sound of those words, even though she didn't understand them. And that had shown to me that we don't need to write down, that we don't have to have kiddie poetry, although there is some very good kiddie poetry.
Oh, right. Well, I think that's true. The sound of Kublai Khan is arresting. And, of course, if you put that to memory when you're younger, you grow into it as you get older. That's the advantage of memorizing when you've got a good memory going.
So you approve of memorization?
Sure, even if at the moment the young person doesn't know quite what the poem means, you never exhaust the meaning of the poems anyway.
I had to memorize poetry as a kid, and I find now that I very much appreciate having that poetry mm-hmm. in my head, and oftentimes when I can't go to sleep at night, I start reciting the poetry, and as you say, I keep finding things, even in these poems that I've gone over hundreds of times.
They keep revealing themselves. I think this is pretty standard, too, in other cultures, that any Englishman or German can come up with a whole repertoire of things that he has to memory, and they frequently share this sort of thing at parties and whatnot.
Mm-hmm. As at our party recently, we had Ulrika.
That's right.
She had memorized the beginning of the Odyssey in Greek.
That's
and
true.
She shared it with us. Mm-hmm. Well, you and I here are talking prose back and forth to each other, and we recognize it as prose, or at least that it's non-poetry. But if I said to you, the start of a poem by T.S. Eliot, Let Us Go Then, You and I, Where the Evening is Spread Out Across the Sky Like a Patient Etherized Upon a Table. Why, then, I think we'd recognize that I was saying poetry, even if we weren't familiar with that poem. And why is this? What do you make as the difference between prose and poetry?
Well,
Why was your dog's name's poetry?
Only insofar as they're in a certain tradition of cataloging. We do this in America because we don't know our country too well, so we list things. This is a device pretty much invented by Walt Whitman, though he got it from the scriptures. And contemporary poets like to do that. That's imitated somewhat by Latin American writers, too, now. In Eliot's case, you got very definite rhythmic lines. Poets tend to think in lines rather than turn sentences or paragraphs.
Mm-hmm. So you have a special kind of rhythm that accentuates the ordinary rhythms of speech.
Right, yes.
And
it's an imitation of speech.
So that the rhythms of your dogs' names, you didn't put those in just any old order.
No, they were written and rewritten and rewritten. I didn't
rearranged.
Read it quite as well as I might have. I was a little nervous here on the microphone.
Mm-hmm.
But you had to gasp for breath to read it anyway, and I didn't have much.
And then I noticed that you built up to a climax at the end.
Yes, that was deliberate.
That the last dog's name was Baron, what was it?
Lumpy von Eichenruh.
Lumpy von Eichenruh.
He belonged to a famous Renaissance scholar.
And so there was a special reason for having him at the end.
He had to be at the end. He wouldn't have done so well at any other position in the list.
If he'd started first, it would have been downhill all the rest of the way.
That's right.
Yeah.
Well, in that Eliot case, he's got a spectacular simile there. The patient etherized on a table is sort of like the sun going down.
It's an image. You used the word image.
Yeah.
And so a simile is an image. That means that something is like something else. It's a comparison.
Right.
And that's a very strange image. It's not an expected one at all.
Yes, the sun going down takes you into sort of the death of the evening.
And then you've got the feeling like of death with a patient, you know, heavy and semi-dead on a table being etherized and sort of stretched out that way, so that the poem has a certain ominousness to it when you put in a simile like that.
Well, that's right. Remember, Eliot was from St. Louis, and they didn't like to see the evening sun go down there.
Mm-hmm.
So he picked up on that, I think.
So you would expect it to be somewhat of a gloomy poem or a sad poem when it starts out. It starts out rather nicely. Let us go then, you and I, where the evening is spread out across the sky, and then you get what really hits you between the eyes.
Get a like shock there.
A shock,
that,
a patient etherized upon a table.
Well, poems really deal with surprise and shock. They, you try to do anything but the expected. So, you know, and you look for connections. If you go out in the can't do it now because of all the rain, but earlier this spring you could have gone out and looked at a lot of flowers. Well, if you looked very closely at this or that flower, you might find that the flower has five petals.
Mm-hmm.
So what does that remind you of? Well, maybe a basketball team. It has five players. The common term is five.
Mm-hmm.
But from there you can make your flowers into spring athletes.
That's right. That's
or they can become waving in the wind like swimmers. That's carrying on from the athletic.
Mm-hmm.
And suddenly you've got something that wasn't quite done before. You don't think of flowers as athletic.
And that the five, noticing five petals makes you think of fiveness. And then
you're moving by associations to find that fresh thing to say.
Mm-hmm.
Which is what Eliot did essentially with the patient etherized upon a table.
One of my favorite little poems is by a first grader, and it is just a simple simile, a comparison, where he says, and he could have done it this spring with the rain, he says, rain is like my little dog's feet on the kitchen floor.
Yeah, that's very
and
nice.
That kind of scrabbling noise, you suddenly have a fresh feel about rain.
Also the pattern. The
pattern, and it also gives you a fresh feeling about the little dog, either way.
He got a double sense in there.
So we're talking about language and words doing double duty. We had Brad say about the catalog of dogs, and you said, I started to say a doggy litany, and you said, no, make it a catalog of dogs, because then we get the word cat in there.
Yeah, I have a little pun going.
It's a little pun going, and even if you listeners didn't get the pun, it probably registered in your head anyway.
Well, the children can make up a catalog of cats. What they'll find is that the cats' names are longer. You'll have cats like Methuselah. That'd be a good name for a cat, but you couldn't call a dog that because when he went after the mailman, you can't say, come back, Methuselah. You just
it's got to be
say,
short.
Come back, Spot.
Right. Well, our time is going on, and we're going to need to make some suggestions for kids writing this week and their poetry writing this semester to start them off. I'm wondering if you've got some particular advice to young poets. Some of these people will be writing for the first time, and others will be sort of old pros at writing poetry. But what would you say to a kid? What are the important things to think about as you begin?
Think about kind of colors you can get in. Poem is a sort of a picture. Think about the sound.
Yeah, I see this, to see.
Yes.
To be able to see something.
But then there's a sort of sound picture, too. Poem is also like a musical piece, so you want to get the various sounds in if you can. Think about the place where you are from. If you're from Verdun, why write a poem about the Eiffel Tower?
Yeah, yeah.
You could, maybe if you're from Verdun, you say, I'd rather write a poem about an Eiffel Tower, but still, that's home. So
there's something in
write
Verdun,
about
like,
what you know there.
What's like Sugar Creek.
What's important? Sugar Creek, right. Well, though Verdun is a little off, Sugar Creek rises just south of Sayre rather than Verdun, I think.
Mm-hmm.
I tried to find that source one day. Failed. But anyway, use the world around you and make it into the poetry that everybody's going to be reading in 20 or 30 years.
Well, I think that's a good place to stop. Let's repeat that for you young poets. Think about colors, painting a picture with your words. Think about sound pictures.
Mm-hmm.
Write from where you are, whether it's the breakfast table or a catalog of cats or dogs or turtles.
And try to see in strange ways how one thing is like another.
You might try particularly for your writing this week to say how something is like something else, like rain is like the little dog's feet, or how the flower petals are five as a basketball team is five, and spring
jump.
Athletes and carry it on a little further than that. So use the world around you and make it into poetry. And John, I thank you so much for starting us off this year with this talk on poetry.
Well, I hope much good comes of it, Jackie.
WSSR Radio has presented Reading and Writing and Radio. Send your writings to Jacqueline Jackson, Sangamon State University, Springfield, Illinois, 62708.